You're listening to the Belly Dance Geek Clubhouse at bellydancegeek.com. Hello, everybody. This is Nadira Jamal, the founder of Belly Dance Geek, and welcome to episode 66 of the Belly Dance Geek Clubhouse. The Clubhouse is a place where dancers can get together and geek out on all of those things that are hard to get in classes and on DVDs. If you want help with the what, things like moves and combos and choreography, there are a lot of resources out there for you. But if you need help with the why and the how, things like music, culture, business, ethics, composition, well, that can be a lot harder to find. So every month we interview a different guest expert on a different geeky topic, and we always have time for question and answer so you can geek out too. If you think that knowledge and creativity go together like chocolate and peanut butter, you are in the right place. My guest tonight is me. This is a special episode of the Clubhouse. Normally, Heather and I interview our guest on an area of their expertise, but this time we're turning the tables. This audio was recorded back in January of 2015 when my business mentor, Julie Eason, interviewed me about why it's so hard to practice consistently and how you can do it anyway. Since we're approaching the new year and everyone has a lot of dance goals and resolutions, we figured this was the best time to talk about how to make the time to practice so you can actually reach those goals. But before we jump onto the audio, I do have one update to share. Near the end of the call, I mentioned my online training course, How to Build a Sustainable Practice Habit. We were offering that for the first time when we made that call. But now we're going to be offering that again for 2019, with the course starting on January 14th. So you can find the full details at bellydancegeek.com/practice-habit.
Well, hello and welcome, everyone. I am Julie Eason, founder of the Belly Dance Business Academy, where I help dancers build more profitable businesses. We are here not to talk about business today. We are here to talk about you and your dance practice, which we all need more of. We are talking today with Nadira Jamal, a.k.a. the Belly Dance Geek, and she believes firmly and strongly that you are the boss of your own dance. Amen, sister. I love that so much. Instead of feeding you moves and choreographies to copy, Nadira teaches you how the dance really works so that you can create it for yourself, the way it feels naturally to you, the way that makes you the most happy and makes your body the most happy. She is the creator of 18 products and services, including the Improvisation Toolkit DVD series, and she's also the hostess of the Belly Dance Geek Clubhouse online radio show. For more geektacular resources, I love that word, visit bellydancegeek.com, and you'll find all sorts of things that Nadira has put together there for you. Welcome to the show, Nadira. It's great to have you here. I'm so excited to talk about this topic.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. I want to start with reality, just plain and simple. It's January 8th. Many of us have set New Year's resolutions. We're going to practice. We're going to dance. We're going to do it every day. We might have even set a time. We might have even put appointments in our calendars. But most of us are not going to do it. Like, statistics are completely against us. We're just not going to manage to establish the habits needed to really make it work for us with our busy schedules, with all of the millions of other things that we have to do every day. So is that what it's like in your world, or are you perfect and you've always practiced on a regular basis?
Neither. For most of my career, I've been a feast or famine kind of practicer. It's kind of like the equivalent of yo-yo dieting, except all dieting is yo-yo dieting, so I don't like to use that metaphor. But it's that thing where, you know, you work really hard for like, you know, 2 or 3 hours on a Saturday, and then you wipe yourself out and you feel like you've done your duty, and then you don't do anything for days or weeks or months. And that was really my reality for a lot of it. I think especially early on, I thought that because I was taking classes really regularly, that I didn't really need to put in the time on my own practice. And then when I got to kind of that advanced student level, it kind of bit me in the butt. And then, you know, I started practicing a little bit more reliably, but it still had this feast or famine pattern to it. And then this other thing happened, which is I got my first dance injury, and it was a bad one. This is when I'd been out in the professional world for just a couple years, and it was a really serious hip injury, and I was essentially spending all of my hip points and all of my hip health just teaching my classes. You know, I wasn't performing. I was just getting through that, and so my own practice really stagnated a lot. So you know, in some cases I went months without practicing just because, you know, I felt like I was spending all of my safe movement time just keeping my classes running.
Wow, that makes total sense. Anytime anybody has an injury of any kind, you kind of want to save it all for your students or save it all for your performances. If that's your income, then you need to make sure that you're, you know, at least 90% if you can. If you can't be 100%, you want to save all that time up. I love how you said hit points, because that's exactly what it feels like. You've got a limited number of minutes that you can dance comfortably. So how did you change that? How did you stop that feast or famine kind of cycle?
You know, that all changed in February of 2014. I was coming off of yet another injury. I've actually had quite a few over the last few years. And I had a pretty important gig coming up. In fact, I'm going to tell you about it because the next event is coming up soon. It's Shimmyathon at Rock On Dance in Vermont. And I was teaching and I was performing last year. And, you know, I was kind of picturing this as my comeback show. And I really wanted to do a good job, but I was coming off an injury. And so I only had so much, you know, I was healed, but I was still a little bit fragile in the body. You know, there's kind of a limit to how hard you can push yourself. And I was also feeling really underconfident because, you know, I'd been performing so little over a couple of years. I actually had overlapping injuries. I had more than one thing going on at a time, which was rough. And so, you know, I had this like awful, you know, I'm going to be terrible and they're going to see the show and they're all going to cancel their signups for my class the next day because I'm going to be so bad. So I was coming out of this horrible place of fear, which is not the way I recommend practicing. But what I decided was, okay, I have, you know, a five-minute set for this. I'm only doing 5 minutes in the show. I'm just going to practice for 5 minutes every morning until the show, right? You know, I'll just run this show once, or I'll just practice the beginning section a couple times, you know, and I'll just do that before I, you know, get dressed in the morning, and that'll be okay. And what happened was I did prepare for the show, and, you know, I was still injured, and I didn't think I did my best, but I felt much safer on stage having had that background. But after the show, what I realized was that, you know, over the course of, I think it was about 4 weeks of practice that I did, I realized that for the first time in a really long time, I really felt like a dancer. One of the things that happens when you have long-term injuries or multiple injuries is that, you know, especially if you're not performing very much, is you stop feeling like a dancer. And I was teaching 5 classes a week, you know, all this, you know, dance-related stuff, but I was feeling like I was no longer a dancer. But just the act of getting into my studio, or sometimes my kitchen, if I was too lazy to go up into my studio, I really felt like a dancer. And so I decided that I wanted to continue that process. And so what happened was I gradually ramped up the amount of time that I was doing. So I started with, you know, just doing that 5 minutes a day. And then I just started trying to sneak into the studio just a little bit earlier every day. So every week I would set my alarm clock 5 or 10 minutes earlier. And over the course of a couple months, I worked up to doing an hour or more every single morning.
Wow, it's almost like you tricked yourself. I want to talk about identity.
Oh, yeah, tricking myself has been really important. So let's come back to that later.
All right, so I want to talk for just a second about identity, because you talked about you didn't feel like a dancer. Even though you were a teaching and you were a professional dancer in that regard, you didn't feel like a dancer. And that is so important, no matter if you are a teacher or a performer or if you have only been taking classes for 2 weeks. If you feel like a dancer, then you are a dancer and you will dance. And if you don't have that identity of saying, I feel like a dancer, then it's really hard to make yourself want to dance because there's like a disconnect inside of you. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So
and I think that it's a kind of a vicious cycle because you don't feel like a dancer, so you don't show up to do the dancing. And because you're not showing up to do the dancing, you don't feel like a dancer.
Exactly. So it's so hard to break that pattern. And all habits and all regular practices of any kind are patterns, right? So why is it so hard to establish that regular practice habit? How do you do that? Why? What's the big deal? Why is it so hard? It should be easy. We love dance, so it should be easy.
You know, I think that, you know, things that are easier are things that somebody else organizes for you, like showing up for class or going to a gig that you've been assigned or showing up for your own classes. But when we're talking about the work that you do on your own that really has to be self-directed, I think there are three big things that come into play. The first one is that our priorities tend to be out of whack. What we think of, the place that we think that dance has in our lives isn't always accurate. The second one is that we rely too much on willpower. You know, there's this sense, especially in Western culture, of this like, just do it, you know, kind of Puritan work ethic thing, that we should be able to push through anything. And I think that's not the case. That certainly hasn't been true for me. And I think the third thing is that we don't necessarily do the investigation that it takes to set ourselves up for success.
Okay. All right. We're going to dig into this stuff because I got some questions for you. Practice isn't really a priority. I almost want to say, how dare you say that? You know, like, what do you mean practice isn't a priority? Because everybody gets defensive. I'm a dancer. Of course practice is a priority, you know. So we immediately in our brain, even if it's ourselves telling us that, we get defensive and we go, what do you mean? Of course practice is a priority. So tell me, what do you mean by practice isn't really a priority? Because it can't be as sinister as it sounds.
Right. Well, I think the problem is that for a lot of people, practice becomes a should and not a want. Especially for like people like me who have this perfectionism problem and feel like a fraud if we're not the best in town at everything.
Yep, absolutely. But I mean, so isn't feeling like you should practice, isn't that a good thing? Isn't it enough if you should practice, that should be enough to motivate you to do it? I think I'm Puritan. I'm totally a New Englander. I just want to say, you know, that's enough. If you should practice, then you should go do it. So what's the deal with that? Did I confuse you? Are you still there?
Sorry, I'm getting muted here on and off.
Oh, no.
If I go out again, let me know. All right.
Okay.
So I think the problem here is that shoulds are paralyzing. They're not motivating. Right? When you think of, you know, there's this idea of intrinsic versus extrinsic motivation, right? Intrinsic motivation are the things that you really want, right? The things that if nobody in the world cared if you did it, you would still want this. And shoulds are kind of coming from this external shame space, right? What will people think of you if you don't do this?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? And so especially for people who really see themselves as being a belly dancer, right? Where being a dancer is a really critical part of your identity. And especially if you have this perfectionist tendency like I do, you know, then there's this sense of, you know, am I good enough? I need to be practicing so I can catch up, right?
Yeah.
If I'm not, and so that kind of turns practice into this nasty chore, not this beautiful expression of yourself as a dancer.
Oh, that makes so much sense. Absolutely. There is that, maybe it's the because of the SH word, but the shoulds and the shame come from the same kind of place. Like, oh man, I'm not doing enough. So why are dancers so unclear on their priorities? Not all the time, but very often they are. So why are they unclear?
I think a lot of times it really does come down to this identity question. And on the one hand, you know, being a dancer is such a wonderful thing to be, and it gives so much of us so much happiness and this place in the world. But when it's a big part of your identity, then, you know, anything related to dance feels like it's a 10 on a scale of 10. I have a program. It's a really intensive coaching program called Be Amazing in the Moment, where I take people through 3 months of seriously intense improv work. And part of the application process is an interview because it's a lot of money and it's a lot of work and, you know, that's not for everybody. And I've had more than one person tell me after the fact that, you know, one of the things that they learned about themselves by going through this interview process is that dance is not the most important thing in their lives. And that's really, really hard to admit, especially if you're out there performing professionally.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And priorities can shift. You know, maybe it was the major thing in your life, and then your priorities have shifted into some other areas, or the other way around. Maybe dance has just become a priority, and you don't really recognize that quite yet. So how can we tell what our real priorities are?
Yeah, so you know, I think the first thing to remember is that just because it's the thing that makes you the happiest doesn't mean it's your first priority. In some cases, so the question I like to ask people is, so what in your life is more important than this? So in my case, the things that are more important than dancing are self-care, so making sure that I'm getting enough rest, taking care of my body, taking care of myself mentally and emotionally, right? My relationship with my husband on a baseline level, So not having the, you know, 10 out of 10 marriage, but having a 7 out of 10 marriage, right? Everything else is a little bit lower than making sure that the baseline is there, right? And the third thing that's more important than dancing is not losing my day job.
Yep.
Right? Not succeeding at my day job, not getting a promotion, but just making sure that I'm, you know, showing up well enough to have the income that's supporting my dance. I did have the wonderful milestone of going part-time at my day job this year, but it's still what lets me spend my time dancing in the way that I want. So until that changes, that's as big a priority as dance is right now. So those are four equal priorities in my life right now. For a lot of people, you may have kids. A lot of other people may have a career that's as or more important than dancing, right? I know a whole lot of academics who are belly dancers who are writing papers, right? And so a real good question to ask yourself is this your life's work? And it's really hard to answer that question no.
Right.
But if you're putting it on your list as a 10 out of 10 and it's not your life's work, then the position that you're putting yourself in is, I should be practicing as if this were my life's work, but it's not. And so you have this disconnect between what you really feel and what your real priorities are and what you're telling yourself about what you should be doing. So I know that there's like the old saw, you can't have it all, right? Mm-hmm. And if you mark everything in your life a 10, nothing's going to get the level of participation and the level of energy that it really deserves.
Right.
So in some cases, go ahead.
I was going to say, I just want to sum it up, but go ahead, you keep going. So I'm going to sum it up after you say whatever you were going to say.
Sure. So, you know, if you take a really honest look at what your other priorities are and you determine that maybe dance is a 6 out of 10 or even a 3 out of 10, then having peace with that role in your life will tell you how much practice really is suitable for its actual role in your life. And so sometimes that means that you should be shooting for less practice than you think you should be doing. And when you find that place, that can actually help you get more done. Because when you feel good about how much practice you're really doing, and it's in line with those, it's going to feel better to do it, and you're more likely to just actually get it done.
Absolutely, and that's actually what I was. That's what I was going to say. Just because you know, that dance is not a 10 out of 10. It's not the most important thing in your life. Listening to it, it sounds like, oh God, it's not the most important thing in my life. I'm there, therefore, I must be a bad person, or I need to be practicing more, or it should be blah 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 blah. Whatever. You can still have a reliable, everyday, beautiful, expressive, healthy dance practice, even if it's not your 10 out of 10, even if it's a 3 out of 10. If it's something that makes you happy, then you just want to scale the amount of time and the amount of, you know, effort and everything that you put in. Because women feel like we have to do 110% at everything. Our families, our jobs, our dance, our hobbies, our exercise, our makeup. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous how much we're expecting ourselves to get out there and do. And so, of course, things fall by the wayside. So I love that you're saying it's okay. Just calm down. If sit down with a piece of paper and ask yourself what's more important, and then appropriately assign, you know, a level of dance that's going to work and that's going to make you proud and happy, because it should make you proud and happy. Did I sum that
Absolutely.
Up right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And, you know, all of this gets complicated by a lot of the discussion that we have in the dance community about professional standards. And this is all important, right? So I'm not saying, you know, take 10 classes and go out there and put yourself out as a professional, right?
Right.
You know, your professional goals and your practice and the quality that you provide need to be there. But if you are already competent to present yourself at the level that you're presenting yourself, it's okay to decide how much harder you want to push yourself based on what your real priorities are.
Exactly. And maybe your priorities are not to practice longer or harder, but maybe you want to explore and grow in different directions. Maybe you want to try tribal if you only do cabaret. Maybe you want to look into the history more. Maybe you want to, you know, do something completely funky and fusion and really challenge yourself in different ways. Maybe try a new prop. It doesn't have to be longer, harder, stronger. It can be different.
Mm-hmm. And often, you know, building, you know, more breath into your repertoire can be this huge, you know, like filling the creative well process. You know, you can get so much more inspiration by exploring differently rather than trying to get your hip drops sharper and sharper and sharper.
Exactly. There's only so much sharp you can get, and then you get into injury. And I think actually, you know, now that we bring that up, I think a lot of injuries do happen because we push ourselves harder and harder and longer and longer. I know in my own sake, I have a chronic knee injury that happened simply because I was demonstrating. I was in a class and I was the most advanced student, and I was demonstrating a simple figure eight. But the teacher went around to every single student, and she corrected every single student and talked to every single student. So I was sitting there doing perfect figure eights with my knees together, my feet together, everything being as perfect as I could possibly make it for like 15 minutes. And now, and this is 15 years later, my knees will swell if I do too much work, you know, at too high of an intensity for a long period of time. So I have to vary things, and I know that about myself now, but I didn't know that then. So, I mean, pushing yourself can actually be unhealthy. Mm-hmm. All right, so let's move on to mistake number two, relying on willpower. Now, this can I want everybody to pay attention, because this can go for dance, but it can also go for eating the cookies when you shouldn't, or I shouldn't say shouldn't, right? Eating the cookies or, you know, doing whatever it is that you're trying to change about yourself or you're trying to do better about yourself. Willpower is this huge, like, looming cloud. That willpower should be enough. So what's the mistake for relying on willpower? Isn't that what we're supposed to be doing?
Yeah. And, you know, getting back to this, like, you know, Puritan backdrop, you know, an awful lot of the advice out there, especially if you read, like, Stephen Pressfield, who wrote The War of Art, a lot of the advice that you get out there is just do it. Just make yourself do it. You're going to have all this resistance, but just do it, right? And that's good advice because you do have to just do it. But it's not useful advice because it doesn't tell you how to make sure that you can do it. I've done a lot of reading in the last couple of years about willpower and habit and talent acquisition and the learning process. And one of the big takeaways that I've taken from all of this is that willpower is a finite resource. If you spend it, it runs out. Now, it does replenish. A lot of people say it's like a muscle, right? The more you practice using it, the stronger it gets. But any muscle, no matter how strong, is going to give out, right? And there are so many things in our day-to-day life that rely on willpower, like not snapping at your boss, not yelling at your kids, you know, making sure that you pack, you know, a healthy lunch instead of grabbing the easiest thing that you can take with you, right? And so there are so many places in our day that we're already spending our willpower that if you're relying on it to help you get through your practice or anything else that's important to you, you know, you're not necessarily spending it wisely. And so if something is important to you, especially if it's something recurring, like setting up a regular practice, instead of relying on willpower, it makes a whole lot more sense to rely on habit.
Ah, there you go. Is that just a semantic change, though? So if we can't rely on willpower alone, how do we make ourselves practice? We do it with habit?
So that's not a semantic difference at all. Willpower and habit are actually two very different things. In fact, in the brain, they behave different. Different parts of your brain come into play.
Really?
So, yes. So habit, I don't actually remember what parts of the brain they are, but if you're interested, there are two books I recommend. One is The Willpower Instinct, and the other is The Power of Habit. So what willpower is it's self-monitoring and self-regulation, right? So your instinct or impulse is to do something, and willpower comes in to help you do something else. Habit is the way that we program our brains to respond to a specific stimulus. So if something happens, we do a certain thing automatically. So willpower is an active, monitoring, controlling force, and habit is an automatic response.
But isn't changing your habits really difficult? Like, if it's automatic, that's what makes it so freaking hard to make that change.
Yeah. So, again, I've done a lot of research on this. And one thing that BJ Fogg, who's a researcher out of Stanford who does behavioral research and habit research, one thing that he says is that habit change is hard, but creating habits is actually pretty easy. And so in a lot of cases, the trick, and I'm stealing this directly from Dr. Fogg, is that instead of trying to change something that you already have in place, to build really tiny little habits that anchor themselves onto behaviors that you already have. So, for example, my habit that started this whole practice thing was after I drank my Diet Coke in the morning, I would do my 5 minutes of practice, right? So that was a tiny little thing, right? You know, I drink my Diet Coke every single morning. That habit was already there. I'm a caffeine junkie and I don't like coffee. And so I would daisy chain this little habit of, you know, just turn my dance music onto that. And this sounds really, really trivial, but the thing is that little tiny habits can lead up to big ones.
All right.
So in my case, yeah. So a lot of that is this idea of like a keystone habit. And again, this is kind of my reading, and I can't remember whose idea this was, and I really wish I could give them credit. But if you can find one tiny little action that you can build a habit from that leads to larger behaviors, then that's how you can set yourself up for success. So in my case, over the course of a couple of months, the way that my habit evolved was after I drank my Diet Coke, I would go into my dance studio, which is a separate room in my house, and turn on my music. Right? That process takes 10 seconds. And so once that habit became solid, that builds onto other habits like I start my warm-up routine. And when my warm-up routine is done, I start a shimmy drill. And by the time my shimmy drill is through, I have the motivation and I'm going and I'm moving, so I feel like practicing more. And so in a lot of cases, the most important habit is just to show up. Just get into whatever space you are in and start moving.
All right, so what habits do we need in order to practice regularly? Like what kind of things can we build off of?
So what I would say the keystone habit is to get into your space and start moving. Now, in my case, I have a whole room in my house, which is awesome. For a lot of people, this is going to be your dining room or your kitchen. That's okay. But if you can make the habit of turning on your dance music and start moving, whether it's a warm-up or just freestyle dancing, if you can build that really strong habit, then that can start a longer practice process. In a lot of cases, you need supporting habits like keeping an appropriate playlist on your iPod or charging your iPod at night to make sure that it has power to support that. And the thing that you need to remember is that anytime you have a habit, it needs to have a trigger. Right? Again, this is something I'm learning from BJ Fogg at Stanford. And that's that a habit has a specific structure. It has a trigger, an action, and a reward. So the trigger is whatever it is that happens in your life that tells you, oh, it's time to do this automatic action. Finish paying Coke. For you, it might be, you know, when you put your purse down after you get in the house. But it has to be something really specific and something that happens at the time you want to practice. If you're a scheduler, maybe you have a little alarm set up on your calendar on your phone, and it goes beep when it's time to practice. That could be your trigger, right? The action is what you want to do. So in this case, it's turn on the moving. And then the reward else for doing that. Now, when people think reward, they often think of things like, you know, having a cookie. And that's a bigger, separate thing. In my case, when I'm done practicing, I look myself in the eye in the mirror, and I say, I practiced. Because I'm a dancer, and that's what dancers do.
So it's
and
like
I
a mantra.
Tremendous identity. I actually do that before I start. I look myself in the mirror and say, I'm here to practice because I'm a dancer, and that's what dancers do. But at the end, it gives me that reward of, yes, I'm a dancer. I feel like a dancer. This is what I want.
You know, I come from a ballet background, and I always felt like as I was growing up and doing it, every ballet class starts with your pliés at the bar, and every practice ends with what they call a reverence, which is going through the five positions with your arms. And for a while I thought it was a cool down, but then I was like, you know what, this is the end. There was a beginning and an end, and it was always the same every single time, and I wonder if that was something that people figured out on purpose. This isn't a question for you, I just think it's fascinating that, you know, a movement practice will always have, I shouldn't say always, in ballet's position that they have a beginning that's very specific and they have an end that's very specific. And it does. It feels good. It's like, okay, I did it. That was wonderful. Mm-hmm. So I want to play devil's advocate with you a little bit, okay, before we move on to number three. I'm going to throw something at you. So we've been talking about getting up in the morning and starting a practice, right? What if we can't do that. What if we have kids to get going and we have too much going on and there's just no way we're going to practice in the morning? We can't drink a cup of coffee and then go practice. It's not going to happen. We have to do it at night or even at noontime or something. What do we do if we're just exhausted, if we've set ourselves up to do it at night and we come home and we've finished cooking and we try to set up, you know, okay, I pushed go on the dishwasher, now I'm going to go practice. Can that work, or does it have to be first thing in the morning?
Okay. The short answer, it does not have to be in the morning, but I strongly recommend that people experiment with morning practice. I am not a morning person. If I had my way, I would do all my creative work from 11 p.m. to 3 in the morning, and I would sleep until 11, and I would sit in bed and read my books and do all this stuff until like 3 in the afternoon, right? I ended up going for the morning because that was the most reliable time for me to press.
That makes sense.
What I've found is that, especially if you're talking about the long haul, right? So not just I need to practice to get ready for a show, but I'm a dancer, I have goals, I want to practice this kind of long haul practice. It's much more important to put your practice in the time when it will happen consistently, not necessarily the time that it will happen the best. Right, I'm quite certain that my brain would be in a better place if I practice at 3 in the afternoon, but I can't do that on most days. And so for most people, the way that most of lives are arranged, the morning is the time when you still have the most control over your day. Now, this does not mean that there aren't kids screaming and needing to be diapered and packed into the car and taken to school, not necessarily the same kids. You know what I mean? Usually the diaper kids aren't going to school. But there's always some point in the morning, even if it's painfully early, where you still have say over what's going to happen in your day. And then what happens is over the course of your day, all these other demands, all these willpower challenges, all these willpower depletions make it harder to do things later. Now, in some cases, people can make, right after they arrive home from work, be a reliable time slot. This is especially true if you either don't have kids or if you have a partner who can take them on at that point, right? If you can block out the time to say, this is my time. But even then, you know, you've got your willpower depleted. You've been dealing with, you know, everybody else's concerns all day. And in a lot of cases, you're going to be emotionally drained. And so if you can give mornings a try, and I, like, for years I laughed at people when they told me to practice in the morning. I laughed in their faces. And now I get up 2 hours earlier than I need to make this happen, right? Now I start work at 10 for my day job. So it's not as early as some people. I get up at 7, which some people may think is perfectly normal. But for me, this is like the crack of dawn, okay? And what I have found is that because I still have control over my day and because my willpower is fresh, you know, I'm not depleted from my big crazy day. That's when it actually is going to happen. So I encourage people to try mornings, even if you think it could not possibly work. I do recommend that you do it really gradually. The only reason I can make early morning work is because I started with 5 minutes, and I worked 10, worked up to 30. So I did this really gradually. But if you do want to do a later in the day spot, the very best thing that I can recommend is to find the most consistent time you possibly can. So something that is anchored to an action that always happens. So right after you get back from work could be a good time, although you are going to have to figure out a way to refresh yourself. In my case, I'm always ravenous when I get home from work, especially if I've had my day job and then taught class and then get home. So when I have practice in the evening, I've had to chug a V8 juice before I can practice. So you know, you need to start you know, thinking about what's going to make that possible. Another option is after dinner, but that can be really tough on if you're doing any kind of hardcore practice with a full stomach can be kind of uncomfortable.
Right.
And another option is, you know, if your kids have a specific bedtime, that can be an option too. So what I used to do, I don't have kids, but what I used to do when I was trying to make evening practice work is I would have dinner with my husband and then we'd watch a TV show together and then I would practice after that show is done. So the food would kind of have a chance to settle and I'd practice at 8:30 or 9 at night. And that, for me, was a little bit more reliable because we had this pattern of watching exactly one episode of a TV show after dinner.
Right.
And so that created that trigger in that regular space.
So the trigger is the thing. If there's some point in your day where there's something that happens completely reliably every single day that you can sort of daisy chain onto, that's going to be the thing that helps you grow your practice and helps you really get it to be consistent. I love that. All right, so all of the things that you've been mentioning so far really are going to lead into this mistake number three, which is not setting yourself up for success. So what do you mean by that? What does it mean to not set yourself up for success?
So as I mentioned before, the hardest part of practicing is just getting started, right? Getting yourself into your space, starting moving, getting through those first couple of minutes when you're like, I don't feel like doing this. I want to go back to bed, or you know, I want to go downstairs and watch TV. And so the funny thing, though, is that it's usually the little things that keep you from getting started, not the big things. Right? There are a lot of big things that can legitimately get in the way, like kids who have needs, taking care of elderly parents, long hours at your day job, right? All of these things are really huge impediments, right?
Mm-hmm.
But those are things that you can kind of work around, right? It's really easy, especially, I've been in an elder care situation when my stepmother was terminally ill. My sisters and I and my stepmother's best friends were swapping in. And she was in another state, so I was flying from Boston to Buffalo every Thursday and flying back every Saturday. And when you have a huge responsibility like that, it's a little bit easier, and again, for women this is not always easy, but easier to say, I really need to carve out time to take care of myself so I can provide care. And so we had a hospice nurse who came for 90 minutes every Friday, which was during my shift, and when she did that, I would take a shower. I would walk down to the coffee shop and have a nice, relaxing breakfast. I would come back, and I would do 20 minutes of practicing, and then I was back on care duty. And so when you have the big things, it's a little bit easier to carve out the time as the thing that you need. But what really tends to get in the way, when we're talking about ordinary day-to-day life, the hardest part is usually getting started. And so it's the tiny little things that can keep you there from getting there.
So like what kind of little things?
The two big things are picking the wrong time to practice, which we already talked about, right? Or choosing a time that's not consistent. So you have to continually exercise your willpower to make it happen, or what I like to call environmental friction. And these are all the details of your physical environment, your workday, your schedule, that can make things just a little bit harder to do. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. I was just going to ask you, how do you stop those little things from holding you back? What do you do about it?
Yeah. So what I started doing is thinking like an engineer. Now, I have engineering degrees, so I have a lot of experience with this. My day job is so I troubleshoot all day, every day. So what I started doing was observing and optimizing, which is geek talk for paying attention and trying new things. So what I started doing was asking myself, what's making this hard? What's getting in the way? How can this be easier? And so, I found all kinds of funny things. So there were a bunch of logistical things. For example, I found that the amount of time that it took me to wash my face, brush my teeth, change into my dance clothes, figure out what music I was going to use, find where I put my hip scarf, was eating up a lot of my practice time. And this was even in the time when I was still just trying to do 5 minutes a day. I would spend 10 minutes trying to get ready. Right? And that was just huge. So I was like, it would eat up all this time I could have been spending practicing, and it would eat up my morale. I just spent all this time, and now I'm only going to practice for 5 minutes, but I have to get to my day job, right?
Mm-hmm.
There were all these little tiny logistical things. I even started sleeping in my practice clothes.
Wow.
So I wear pajamas. I sleep in yoga pants and a T-shirt. And so when it's time to practice, I throw on a bra. I hope that's not too information for anybody. And I go straight up there in the same clothes I've slept in. Now, if I smell really bad, I'll change, but it's just like all kinds of little tiny things. There were also some physical things that make a difference. So I realized that if I wanted to practice for any real amount of time, I had to eat something.
Mm-hmm.
But that also had all kinds of logistical things. So I found that yogurt worked. So I tried all kinds of different things that I could eat in the morning, but things that took up too much time or that made me feel wrong, would get in the way of practice, whereas just the right amount of fuel with not taking too much time would keep me going.
Right.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, your brain will come up with anything it can possibly think of to kind of prolong and stop you from making this, habit happen.
Mm-hmm. So you have to trick yourself. You have to trick yourself into getting past all of those things. I even found that, I'm not a morning person. I hate getting up in the morning. But I also realized if I tried to practice first thing in the morning, like if it was the first thing that I tried to do, then it would feel like this terrible burden. Like, oh my God, I have to get up, I have to get out of bed, I have to go practice, this sucks, right? So what I started doing is I started waking up half an hour earlier, which is completely counterintuitive, right? If you're thinking, I'm not a morning person and I don't want to get up to dance, why would I get up earlier? But I got up half an hour earlier so I can read my book. If I sit in bed and I read a book, then I feel like I've had a slow enough morning that when it's time to practice, it doesn't feel like this burden. And that's not going to be the case for, you know, 3/4 of the people reading this, but it's just all these little tiny observations. So I was saying, what's making this hard? And the answer was I was feeling petulant mm-hmm. about dancing right away. And so how can this be easy? The answer was find a way to give myself the experience of a slower wake up.
Yes, I love those questions. Why is this hard for real? Like, look inside yourself. What's really at the core of making this difficult to do? And how can it be easy? When you ask those questions, your brain will just give you answers. It's awesome.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, this morphs over time, so you do have to keep observing and keep tweaking. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you can keep tricking yourself and outwitting yourself and get yourself up there because, again, the hardest part is getting started. Once you get up there and you get moving, it's a whole lot easier.
And it's almost a game. It's like, oh, I did it. I win. Mm-hmm. I outwitted myself. All right, so what else can you do to set yourself up for success? What are some other things?
Yeah, well, there are a couple other things. So getting into this, like, observing and optimizing thing, another good question to ask yourself is what has to happen before I can practice, right? So what items do I have to have ready? What state does my body have to be in? How awake do I have to be? And then how can you get all of those out of the way in advance and easily? So, for example, my sleeping and my practice clothes is one option there. And another thing that you can do is take a look at your excuses. We put all this, like, nasty self-flagellation around excuses. Your excuses are actually the best clue to finding the friction in your life, right?
Yep.
If you find yourself making an excuse, instead of beating yourself up and saying, just do it, that's stupid, take a look at how you can turn that around. How can you make that excuse not a problem? If you imagine that this is a problem that somebody else is having really legitimately, how could you go about solving that for them, right? Something about putting it on another person makes a little less judgy.
Yep.
So, you know, this comes back to that example of, you know, I didn't feel like I could do the first thing unless I had had my downtime. So, you know, that was this excuse that I was feeling, so that's what I took on. I think the most important thing that you can do to set yourself up for success is to make sure that you have a source of accountability. Even when you have a well-established habit, when you know that somebody else is watching and somebody else cares whether you do it and whether you're making progress towards what you want, that's a really big motivator. I've had this in a lot of places in my life, and it makes a big difference. So one is when I was working with you back in 2008, when we were doing business coaching.
Yep.
When I knew that I had a phone call with you every single week, I worked my butt off to make sure that I checked everything off my list. Whereas if you had given me that list but you weren't checking in, I might have done half of it.
Right, exactly.
Another example is that I use a language program online called Duolingo. Language learning program. It works a lot like Rosetta Stone, but it's a little bit more fun, and there are levels, and one of the big deals about that is that you have a streak, right? So if you practice every day with the program, then you establish a streak, right? So I think, you know, if you get up to 17 days your Spanish practice, right, you really don't want to break that streak because you have it's socially connected, so you have friends established in the program, and they're going to see if you break your streak, right?
Exactly.
And it's not a shame thing. It's not an embarrassment thing. It's a, you know that somebody who cares and who wants you to have what you want is watching.
Right. It's like when you had gold stars when you were a kid, when your mom wanted you to clean your room or make your bed or something, and they'd put little gold stars on the refrigerator. It's the same idea. Or, you know, just even the idea of grades. When we have this ingrained in us since we were kids, where, you know, somebody cares about us, our teacher cares about us, and they want us to do this homework, or they want us to do whatever it is that we need to do in class, and so we're going to do it because we're accountable to that teacher. It makes total sense. We've got this ever since we were practically born. We've got to be accountable to people, and that makes us feel like we're accomplishing something.
Mm-hmm. It actually ties into this, you know, we have to give 110% thing, mm-hmm. where, you know, so much of the pressure, especially on women, is to give everybody else what they need, right? Not only do you have to take good care of your family, but you have to take better care than everybody else, and you have to be supermom, right? And you don't just have to keep your day job, but you have to get a promotion every year, right? And like all this like huge you know, responsibility to other people. And I think when all that pressure is on us, it's very, very easy to put what we want last.
Absolutely. And it's virtuous to put it what we want last. It's, you know, we're better people because we're doing that.
Right. And the thing is, you know, as I kind of alluded to earlier, when you put yourself last, you undermine your ability to give, right? If you're not filling the well, you can't dip in the well, right? And so under this pressure, we tend to, if we have to cross something off the list, almost always it's the thing that we want for ourselves. And so that's where accountability really comes in, because when you have somebody else watching and holding you accountable, the thing that you want for yourself can kind of be put up on par with the other thing. So instead of your practice always going on the chopping block, well, if you know that's happening, if you know that somebody's watching, you're much more likely to make it happen. I mean, you know, I have my streak going on Duolingo, and if it's 11:30 and I want to go to bed and my husband wants to go to bed, I've got 10 minutes to make sure I can keep my streak.
Yep, absolutely. I have a little app on my phone that will do the same thing. You can set up whatever kinds of streaks you want. I think it's called Chains or something, and you make chain links. And you can do it for, you know, you can have five of them going at one time. And all you have to do is hit it on your phone, but you've got it. Your phones are, you know, if you're like me, your phone is always with you and always on, and you see it. And you're like, oh God, I've got to do that. I've got to get it done. I've got to be able to tap that chain so I can, you know, mark off one more day. So any way that you can have some kind of accountability, even if you have a partner or somebody else who you know is going to check in, that's a great thing to have set up. All right, should we recap what we've learned? Because we've learned so much. This has been an amazing call. I'm thinking number one is figure out what your priority is, right? You've got to decide where dance is put out an appropriate amount of time for practice and appropriate amount of effort. And just because dance isn't a 10 on your list, that's okay. You don't have to push for a 10. So figure out where your priorities are. Then don't rely on willpower. Make it a habit, right? Set it up so that it's going to have a trigger and a reward, and there's something in the middle. What was in the middle?
One of those is just make sure that you have a really reliable time slot.
Right, that was it. Okay.
The consistent time is better than the optimal time.
Right, and then make sure you set yourself up for success and don't let the little things or the big things, if you can help it, get in the way of your practice. Make sure you're setting yourself up with accountability and making sure that you figure out why things are getting in the way and how you can make them easier. Just those three things alone. Make a game out of it. Gamification is just one of the things that it's really hot in business right now. It's like, how can we make this a game? Everything is turning into a game because they're learning that, you know, people are becoming addicted to video games, and anything where there's that trigger and that reward, our brains just light up and we're going to keep doing it all the time. So anything that people in business can turn into a game is good, and it's sort of bleeding out into other areas of our lives, even into our social lives, where we can, you know, just have those triggers and rewards. And it's an amazing psychological phenomenon, and it's a little bit creepy to me, frankly. But that's okay. We can use it for good. We can use it for good. All right. So if listeners, we're going to have some Q&A in just a minute, but if they want to establish their own practice habit this year and they want to get help, and you know so much about this topic, you set up your own dance practice for an entire year, and I was one of those people who was a sort of fly on the wall and watched how you actually did it and how you overcame all of the problems that were in your way. And I mean, you really do have this down to a system. So how can they get help from you if they want it?
Yeah, I have an online course coming up. We're starting in just 10 days, and it's called How to Build a Sustainable Practice Habit. So, you know, we've talked about some of these obstacles to creating a sustainable habit, and what I really wanted to do was to put together a step-by-step program that would walk you through this same process. Now, my life is not going to be the same as your life, but what I did is I took a look at what I did. Not so much the specific changes that I made, but the process that I followed, and I reverse engineered that. So what I did was I broke out each of the pieces of what it took to establish this habit, and then I made them a little bit more abstract. So instead of saying, this is what I did, it would be, what would you have to do to find your own solution to this problem, to figure out what your own obstacles are? So we have a 9-week online course that's going to start on Monday, January 19th, and go through Sunday, March 22nd. This all happens entirely online, so you don't have to show up for anything. And over the course of 9 weeks, we're going to do a couple of things. The most important thing is that we're going to gradually ramp up your dance practice. So in the first week, we're going to start with a hilariously short minimum daily practice. So literally, all you have to do is show up for 2 minutes every day and practice, and that's it. 2 minutes. Now, the reason that it's hilariously short is because that means actually you do it. You know, if I said, okay, well, we're going to start with half an hour of practice, you might do it some days and not others, but anybody can do 2 minutes a day. I don't care if your newborn is still screaming. I mean, not screaming. You don't want to leave a screaming baby. But, like, you know, when I was a babysitter and I was babysitting infants, when they napped, I napped. I was so tired. I know that moms who have to stay up all night with them are equally tired and often do that. But if your kid has just gone down for sleep and you need to practice, you can do 2 minutes of practice before you lie down with them, right? Now, granted, it was not necessarily the best time to establish a practice habit, but that was just an extreme example. So we're going to start this hilariously short minimum, and then every week we're going to ramp it up just a couple minutes. So over the course of 9 weeks, we're going to go from 2 minutes a day to an hour a day. Now, if your practice goals don't call for an hour of practice every day, that's okay. You can set a shorter minimum for yourself. So you might want 20 minutes a day, or you want to do 5 minutes every morning, just a quick shimmy drill, and then twice a week you do half an hour, right? That might be a more realistic choice for you. But whatever your personal maximum is, we're going to gradually work our way up to it, and we are going to examine what your actual needs and goals will be. So that's going to happen throughout the course. And then each week we'll approach a different aspect of practice. So what the pieces are that you need to have in place to establish a really sustainable long-term practice habit, not just something that will get you to your next show. So we're going to work on finding your real motivation. So instead of relying on the carrot and stick approach, we'll take a look at what really intrinsically motivates you, what the shoulds are that are clouding your goals, and really find what your wants are. And then we'll translate that into what a realistic practice goal for that would be. We're going to talk about the role of willpower and habit, so where it is worth spending your willpower to support your practice, and really finding out how you can build those keystone habits that will build to a sustainable practice. We're going to talk about reducing friction. So just like I was talking about, you'll learn how to think like an engineer, observe and optimize. And I'm going to give you a sick list of things to watch for in your environment, in your schedule, and also in your own attitudes so that you can figure out what's easier and harder to practice. And then I'll help you experiment with little tweaks to make that more likely to happen. Also, prepare for problems. So there are some bigger and medium-sized things that can jeopardize your practice. So talk about how to deal with injury. I have a whole lot of experience there. How to deal with illnesses. I actually have a big sinus bug going on right now, so I took today as a sick day. I didn't practice, and that was part of my plan. I had a plan in place for dealing with this, and you will too by the end of this course. We'll also talk about how to deal with things like vacations, interruptions, setting boundaries with the people in your life. For example, I don't answer the phone during my time. period. And also how to get the support that you need from other people in your life so that you can make time for practice. Then we'll talk about how to make the most of your practice time. When it comes to a lifelong practice habit, the most important thing is showing up consistently, right? Doing it reliably is more important than what you do. But once your habit is really starting to firm up, you can start thinking about how to get as much benefit out of your practice time as possible. So we're going to talk about how to set short-term goals, how to turn them into a practice plan, how to structure a practice session, what types of practice are effective, how to use DVDs effectively. So sometimes DVDs are procrastination, and sometimes they're really effective practice tools. We'll talk about how to keep working when you feel like giving up. One thing that I experienced during my turnaround was that when I was doing short practices, like 5 or 10 minutes, this was not a problem. But once I started getting into the 45, 60, 75-minute range, sometimes I would just feel like giving up, right? I had a whole lot more stuff on my list that I wanted to work on and that I was excited about working on. And if I was frustrated or a little tired or a little bored, I felt like stopping. And so one thing I'd really like to take you through is how to build practice strategies to ride that wave of frustration or boredom to get your motivation back. And this is not a just do it approach, right? It's not keep going. In a lot of cases, it's really about tricking yourself to get past that point. So for example, one trick that I use is just 2 more minutes, right? If I'm like, this practice sucks, I don't want to do it, I want to go downstairs and have another Diet Coke, then I'll tell myself, I can do that, I can quit, as long as I do 2 more minutes first. And by the time I get to that point, I usually feel like continuing. We've got that and a whole bunch of other really simple tricks that you can explore and really see which ones work for you and which ones don't, so that you'll have those in your toolkit. We're also going to take a look at setting long-term goals. So really taking a bigger picture look at what you want out of the dance, what you want to accomplish, what its role in your life should be, and how to make sure that the work that you're doing in your practice is going to help lead you towards those larger goals. And then to the end, we're going to take off the training wheels. So we're going to create a plan for how you can maintain your practice habit for life and not just when you have me looking over your shoulder. So we'll reevaluate whether you want to keep practicing at all. And depending on your goals, you may decide that you don't, and that's okay. But if you do, we'll help you reevaluate how much you want to practice, and most importantly, how you're going to get accountability once the course is over. So I'm not going to just drop that out from under you. We'll help you make your own strategy for finding that. And also creating a plan for what you'll do when you get off track, because everybody gets off track, and that's okay. What matters is that you get back on. So by the end of the course, you'll have a steady practice habit, 9 whole weeks of practicing. You'll have the know-how to spend that time wisely, tools to keep you on track, and strategies to help you get back on track when you do fall off. So this is going to be a 9-week online course. When I say online, what I mean is I'm going to be sending you email. So every email you'll get a weekly assignment, and this will have a training audio. So this will be an MP3 file that will introduce you to the concepts and the tools that we're working with that week. I'll also provide a PDF transcript because I know a lot of people would rather read than listen. And also, if you want to refer to it, the written version is better. And also a worksheet that will help you go through the exercises that will help you put those tools and concepts into work supporting your practice. That week's assignment will also include your week's practice goal, which again is going to ramp up from 2 minutes to 60, but you customize that. And then every day I'm going to ask you to check in. So this is a way that you're going to have accountability. And so it'll only take a minute or two. All you have to do is go to our private check-in page and tell me whether you practiced, did practice, or were taking a scheduled day off. It's all you have to do, and it's private. We'll have 2 Q&A calls during the program so that you can ask me questions in a larger sense. And we'll also have a private Facebook group. So this is going to be just for course members. It's a safe and confidential space. You can talk to the other classmates. And this is where you can ask me help on a day-to-day basis. So I'm going to be checking this every day, usually a couple times a day. So if, you know, you're having trouble identifying what's wrong or you coming up with a solution, then I can help you out with that. Again, I have a lot of experience with troubleshooting in the dance space and outside it, and I love doing this, so I'd be really happy to help you. Now, we are doing this in two formats. So there's kind of a go-it-alone version, because I know some people really hate working in groups. So if you really just don't want to be involved with anybody and you want to do the work by yourself, you can do that. And that version includes the homework and the Q&A calls. And then we also have what I'm calling the premium package, which includes all of that, plus the Facebook group and the accountability check-ins. So again, we're going to start on Monday, January 19th, and end on Sunday, March 22nd. And the program is going to cost $99 for the Go It Alone version and $109 for the premium. So it's only $10 more if you want daily access to me for help and those two Q&A calls. So I do recommend that you go with that. Because accountability is a huge deal. But again, I know some people really hate that, and they may be shy or, you know, just don't like working in groups, and that's okay. So I am making that option available. Send that back to you.
Are you ready for me to jump in here? I didn't want to interrupt you. You were on a roll there. I am so excited about this program. Okay, so everybody who is listening on this call, I know you might have questions to ask Nadira about any of the things that we've covered so far. Maybe you have a specific situation that you want to ask her about. So we're going to open up the phone lines in just a minute to do that. So I want you to just sort of give you a minute to think about, you know, what your questions might be, and if you want to write them down, that might be a good idea. But I want to bring up two really important points about this particular program. There's not another program out there like it that I know of, whether it's in the dance world or any other world. I've not ever heard anybody go through something like this and to create such a huge resource for a group of people. And the first thing that I just want to say, the value of having a community of people who are going to do this together is huge. Like, you can absolutely take everything that we've talked about today, and you can go off and you can have a really successful practice that you set up, and you make it run for the next 10 years, and you can do that, and it's awesome, and you have all the tools you need. But if you're the kind of person like I am, who I know that I'm gonna start going and I'm gonna do that roller coaster thing, that feast or famine, where I'm practicing and then I'm not practicing, and I'm doing it, and I'm like, all right, I know all the tools I need to do. Nadira told me all the tools. I'm just gonna do it, and it's so much easier when you have a group of people who care about you succeeding. So if you're serious about doing this and you know you want to have this set up, go just order this. This is like a total no-brainer. You really want to be part of this particular program. I know that Nadira cares deeply about this topic and about dancers in general and women in general, and is going to be a fantastic group leader for this. The other thing I want you to think about is that you're learning a process. Okay, yes, you're learning how to set up a dance practice, but you're learning a process that's going to apply to any habit you ever want to set up in your entire life. If you want to write a novel and you know you need to, I'm a writer, so I can totally get into this one. If you know that you need to write every single day, you can use this exact same process that you're going to go through in this program to set up that habit. Or maybe you want to set up a habit of cooking your meals ahead of time, you know, on Sunday, so that you're ready for the week, so that you set yourself up for success. Any habit that you ever want to do for the rest of your life, you're going to know how to do it because you're going to have gone through this course. So just keep those things in the back of your mind. I'm so excited about this. It's going to be an awesome, awesome 9 weeks. All right. With that said, I'm going to open up the lines. Actually, Nadira, I'm going to turn it over to you because you're the one with the answers. So people are just going to ask you questions, and you can handle all the controls. So I'm handing it back to you, babe.
All right. And, you know, I realized I didn't actually tell you where you can sign up for this program, so let me do
that
first.
That's really important.
That's important, yeah. So that's at bdancegeek.com/practice-habit. So that's practice-habit. And a little bit after the call, I'll also link that from the front page, so you should be able to find it if you just go to bellydancegeek.com. I'll also send out a follow-up email that'll have a link to this recording, and I'll also make sure that I include it there.
Only like 21.
Okay. So we are going to go ahead and open this up for questions and answers. So there are a couple ways that you do this. So if you are looking at the webcast, so if you're at the UB conference website, you can type in questions in the little question box that's available on the right. There's a little button that looks like it has a little cartoon speech bubble, and that will expand the question box. You can type in a question right there. If you're on the phone, you can press ** to unmute yourself. And if you're on Skype, then you can press ** on the Skype keypad. Once you unmute yourself, just say hi and tell me so we know who we're talking to.
Hi, I'm Liz from New York City.
Hi there. How are you?
Good, good. Thank you for doing this. This has been a lot of great information. I have copious notes here. I've got copious notes written down.
Excellent. So do you have a question?
Not off the top of my head. I was hoping someone else had a question.
Okay. Well, I'm really glad you enjoyed it. I'll go ahead and mute you again, but if you do come up with a question, you can press ** to unmute yourself.
Okay.
Thanks. Okay. Hi there.
Hi. So what if you have done all these tactics already, but for something else, and you need to now find a way to find a new time and a new way to put in a new habit in your life? Because I did everything you said with the morning and the routine and for fitness, and I don't want to stop doing fitness. But I'm afraid if I try to move fitness, then I'll lose it.
Okay, so you feel like your kind of prime compliance time is taken up with that one. Okay, so
taken to a habit, yeah.
Okay, so there are a couple things I can think of. So one is, I would ask, out of these two things, these two competing priorities, right, dance practice and fitness, which is more important to do consistently? And the answer might be fitness. So this is not, you know, I'm telling you to swap time slots. But if, you know, fitness is something that you can squeeze in here and there and still get what you need from it, and dance is something that you really do need to do consistently, then it might make sense for that to go in that time slot. The other thing to look at is which one of those is the hardest to start. Right? Is it harder to jump on the elliptical, or is it harder to get your dance practice started? And whichever of those two that it is, put that one in the reliable time slot, whichever one's harder to get started. Making time in a second time slot is tricky, but it might work. So especially if you find that, you know, if you just like jump on the elliptical and, you know, put a TV show on your iPhone and slog through, if that's something that you can do when your energy is lower, right, after a big draining day at work, it might make sense to put that in that time slot. Another thing, and not being a morning person, I don't recommend this often, is to see if you can daisy chain the two of them together. Obviously, it's more tiring to dance and do your fitness stuff in the same time slot, but if you're already doing, you know, half an hour or 45 minutes or whatever of cardio and exercise in the morning, can you add half an hour onto that of dance practice? Or even for 5 minutes, right? Can you do your elliptical stuff and then jimmy for 5 minutes? Can you work up 20 minutes there? Because, you know, 20 minutes every morning adds up to a whole lot. So even if it's not necessarily the full long-term practice that you'd like to do, if you can just tack on a little bit, because you have this strong anchor habit already of doing this exercise stuff, and so if you can sneak in some dance into that, again, it doesn't mean getting up just a hair earlier, which, not being a morning person, I don't love, but that could be a thing that could help. Another thing that's occurring to me is there any way that you can make them overlap? You know, can get some of your fitness stuff through dance. So obviously this is going to depend on what your dance goals are and what you need to work on. But, you know, for example, if I know who you are, I'm not going to get into too much detail, but I know for a fact that you can improvise full routines. So, you know, if some of your fitness time is being spent on cardio, could you put on a full routine, you know, for 15 or 20 minutes or 25 minutes, and do that full bore as if you were performing, because that might provide some of the same cardio benefit. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It's an interesting suggestion. I think it would be easier for me to start by doing like a little bit in the morning after working out, because I slow so far down in like middle of my five-part routine that I would be sitting there obsessing about my heart rate. So thank you.
Yeah, and actually, if I can add one more thing onto that, too. You know, your practice doesn't have to be a one-time during the day thing. One thing that you could do would be, you know, tack some of it onto your morning exercise routine and then tack on something so small that it's not a big deal that you do later in the day. So, you know, maybe when you get home from work, you put on a slow song and work on your pretty arm stuff, you know, and then maybe, you know, you put the dishes in the thing to me for 5 minutes, right? So it might be something breaking up into smaller pieces that don't feel like huge drains on your day. That might also be a strategy that's worth trying. Again, this is all really personal stuff, so a lot of it is experimenting and trying, but that might give you a couple of ideas to try out, see.
Well, thank you.
My pleasure, and let me know how it works out. Okay, to mute you again, if you have any more questions, though, feel free to press ** to unmute yourself. Okay, I'm not seeing anything in the webcast, but let me scroll back a little bit.
Hello?
Hi there.
Hi, this is Melissa from Belchertown, Mass. And my question is more about, I have a really erratic schedule because I work in retail. And so, like, I have start days that, like, there are days when I start at, like, 7 o'clock in the morning, and then I have other days where I start either at 10 a.m. or 5 p.m., so I'm all over the place. Do you have, like, a good recommendation on how to, like, get into a good habit, like, setting a time?
Yeah.
Considering
so when your schedule... Definitely. So now, is this something that changes really frequently, or is it something where, like, on a Monday it's this schedule and on a Thursday it's the schedule?
My Tuesday, Thursdays are pretty much always set at 7 a.m. And then my Mondays are all over the place. Sundays are all over the place. Saturdays I usually start at 5. And I usually don't work on Wednesday and Friday.
Okay. So you have some rigor, you're in some things that aren't.
Yeah.
What I would recommend is instead of focusing on specific time slots, see if there are any activities in your day that could act as the anchor. So rather than, you know, if you have to be at work at 7 in the morning, you probably don't want to get up early enough to do a serious practice on those days. Yeah. But if you do want to practice in the mornings on other days, could you do something like 5 minutes on your crazy early days just to maintain, like, the before breakfast anchor or whatever it is, you know, or even 2 minutes, you know, like you have a 2-minute song, you put it on and you've done your early days. And then in that same anchor point on other days, you can do a more full practice. Another thing that you can do is, you know, so on your steady days, you have a specific anchor, and on your crazy days, you have just kind of a little token practice to inhabit. And let me say that this seems really trivial, okay? You look at this and you're like, what good can that possibly do? But the thing is that, you know, habit is an automatic thing that happens in your brain. And so the process of creating a habit is telling your brain, every time you experience X, do Y. And so even if all you do is dance for a tiny, tiny, tiny bit, you're going to create the structure in your brain that's going to create a craving to dance. Right? And so if you're not doing, you know, an hour or half an hour or anything even substantial, if you can show up for just that tiny little bit to say to your brain, yes, I am still doing this habit. I do still want you to make me crave practice in the morning or after lunch or whatever your trigger point is, that might be a really helpful thing to do.
Okay.
I would try that first. If that doesn't work, and when I say doesn't work, I mean, you know, you troubleshoot and you decide that, no, really, this isn't the thing. You can also look for, try and create multiple triggers. So, you know, if you know that you're going to have to do an evening time slot on some days, even if you don't know what that day is going to be because it's going to change, right, then, you know, just try and establish that, you know, if I have had to work early, then my time slot is after dinner or after watching TV after dinner or whatever it is. Problem with that is that it's going to cost a little bit more willpower. Make it happen. But if that is really the only thing that works for you, then that is a good place to spend your willpower. It's just going to be a little trickier. And you can try splitting up what you need to do into smaller pieces. That might be easier. because it'll be easier to start, because it won't feel like, oh, God, I have to do this whole hour-long thing. It's, no, I just really need to do my shimmy drill. Or I should just really run this choreography I'm working on.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does. It does. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Right. My pleasure. I'm going to put you back on hold, but if you think of anything else, you can press star to ask another question. All right. I don't see anything else in the webcast. If anybody on the phone or Skype wants to ask a question, you can press star to unmute yourself. These have been good questions. I like these. Another thing is, if anybody wants to chime in with any crazy tweaks that they've tried in their own practice, I'd love to hear what yours are. My personal favorite is sleeping in my PJs, but it's not the only one out there. I mean, sleeping in my dance clothes. But I'd love to hear what tweaks you've got too. Okay, I'm going to make this the official last call for questions. If anybody has any, you can press star to unmute yourself, or you can type in a question in the Q&A box on the right side of the screen.
This is Kava in Oakland, California.
Hi there.
Hi. I was wondering if your class, the 9-week course, was for dancers at all levels.
Yes. Absolutely. Depending on your skill level, you may want to practice more or less. But really, it's not even so much about skill as it is about priority. Like, you know, a beginner who wants to get up to the intermediate class as possible may want to practice for an hour every day eventually. But no, this is about the process of getting to practicing rather than what you practice. So you can do it at any level from a beginner to a professional.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Okay, any other questions? All right, I think that's that. Julie, I'll hand it back to you.
All right, awesome. We're going to play toss here because I just want you to say one more time where they can go to register.
Yes, people can go to bellydancegeek.com/practice-habit.
Awesome. I'm so excited for this course. I can't wait to just tell everybody I know about it. Even if they're not dancers, they could get so much out of this. All right. Well, for now, I'm going to just say thank you so much, Nadira, for sharing all this great information. It couldn't have come at a better time when we're all 1 week into our New Year's resolutions and we're all, like, starting to feel the weight of that, oh, man, I got to go exercise again or I got to go dance again. So this has been a great, great call. I really appreciate you spending all the time with us. And for everybody on the line and everybody listening on the recording, I will just say goodbye for now and have a wonderful, happy dance practice. Bye-bye for now.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. For more Geektacular resources, check out bellydancegeek.com.